Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Welcome to the Songwriter Connection, the podcast that delves deep into the art and heart of songwriting. Each week, we gather around the dining room table to uncover the stories behind the songs. We invite you to join us on a journey to the creative minds of the songwriters who shape the melodies of our lives. From Nashville, Tennessee, here's your host, Dave Linehan.
Well, it's... Oh, come on.
All right. All right.
Not a live audience like we were at the local a few weeks back, but we've got Taylan, who is back. Taylan Ray.
Hi.
And her husband, Alan Sanderson. This is episode number 220, and it's going to be a special one because we've got a lot of cool stories to share with you.
Yes, we do.
If you didn't listen to Taylan's podcast, I think we called it Lessons with Tay-Tay, because she's a great vocal coach, but also a great singer and done some great things, and a great songwriter. We did mention that there was this studio out in San Diego called Pacific Beat, and Taylan and Alan own that studio.
Yep.
And I had to get out there and see it for myself. So back in February, Patty and I flew out with some friends and finished up my new EP out
Yay!
There.
Nice. Yeah.
And I want to tell you a bit about Alan. He is a Grammy Award winner, and he has engineered some of the top albums. I mean, here's just some, I'm just going to throw out some names, okay?
Okay.
These are just some of the people that Alan Sanderson has worked with. Fleetwood Mac.
That's right, yep.
Michael Jackson.
Uh-huh.
The King of Pop. Elton John.
Mm-hmm.
Fiona Apple. B.B. King. Are you kidding me? Counting Crows. Elvis Costello. You worked on the album with him in Burt Bacharach.
That's right. Yep.
That's got to be some stories. Ryan Adams, Weezer, The Rolling Stones.
Yep, that's right.
Is there anybody you haven't worked with that you say, I've got to someday?
You know, it's funny, when you read that stuff off to me, I get exhausted just thinking about a lot of it, you know.
You've done a lot, man.
There's been a few sessions. People say, well, it's quite a journey. It's taken a few years of my life, probably.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, it's been a great ride. I've really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Who would I like to work with? Mm-hmm. Well, I finally got to work with the great Dave Linehan in the studio.
Oh, well.
Not too long ago. That was terrific.
Despite that, you're okay.
Right? You know, that was back in February. Feels like a long time ago now that we got to do
it
stuff.
It does, doesn't it? In a way, it seems like day before yesterday.
It does.
This was really a good trip. It was really, I was a little kid last time I was in California, so I really had to experience California, not having been there. And I just fell in love with the vibe.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's a very different down there. I mean, San Diego's a very unique place compared to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And it's more of a destination spot, but you don't think of it as a recording scene by any means.
By any means. And so how did you come to have a studio there? And it's just blocks up from the Pacific Ocean.
It's a couple of blocks away.
Yeah.
We got really lucky. We were manifesting it for many months, years probably, if I think about it. And it just kind of fell into our lap through a bunch of different things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was always kind of a goal of mine to make one of the best studios in San Diego.
And it really is.
Because, you know, a lot of those records you mentioned was all up at this great studio called Ocean Way
in Hollywood. Yeah.
In the 1990s, which I guess now would be looked upon as the golden age of recording.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time working with those people because that was the place to go. I moved up through the ranks. And,
now, I just have to ask you, there's Big Ocean Way in Nashville. Were they?
Well, that's right. Ocean Way Nashville and Ocean Way in Hollywood was the same. It was owned by the same guy, a guy by the name of Alan Sides, who started it. Brilliant engineer in his own right. But I always kind of wanted to create a place that had that quality of sound in San Diego, and there was nothing like it. I'd moved to San Diego as a young guy from Europe. And it always had a special place for me. And I
came from Scotland. Was it
Scotland? Yeah. Came out from Scotland originally.
I'm hearing it for the first time. Really, I'm hearing a little bit of that accent.
Well, the more we talk about recording, it comes out because every recording guy is British, right? So, you know, but one of the things that was important to me was getting back to San Diego. Originally, I was going to just take a break there from Los Angeles. And I said, let's create something really cool here. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to another. And Pacific Beat was created in 2014. And it's been going ever since. The studio itself had been there, has been there for 50 years. A classic place that was built when people really knew how to build studios. Mm. And we were very lucky to find it.
It's really beautiful.
It's really a great spot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's this sign hanging up above the vocal booth that says, it's all about the vibe.
It's all about the vibe. It's very important. That's one of the things I learned working with all those characters.
I brought that back with me. That's my favorite new thing.
We should have given you the sign. It's funny because actually one of my clients gave me that sign. She was a dentist.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, be careful.
It was her daughter was in the studio, and she became our dentist, and she gave it to me for my birthday one of those years.
Oh, that's
and,
cool.
It was like, you know, it was great. So it was a good memory.
Yeah, that's all I see. It's all about the vibe. It really is.
It really is. We use that term a lot, vibe.
Do you?
Yeah, well, everybody does now. I've heard it like 15 times today from other people just sitting around, and it's so important, isn't it?
I mean, it really is.
You know, you came out there and you made your record, and you were in the room with a bunch of great musicians, and
we
created this ambiance and that kind of creative spirit, which I think is really important in the record making process, and I really think has been lost to some degree.
But you know what I love the way you did, because I've recorded here in Nashville and now out in San Diego, it was a little different. You put together a heck of a band, let me tell you, with Mark Twang in Trevaya.
It was great.
And we had Nucci on the drums. He's great. Who's playing bass?
It was James East.
James East.
James East was playing
bass. I wanted to say West, and you know that was right. Yeah. And we had Paul Castellanos.
That's right. Paul Castellanos popped in and gave us a little bit of his expertise.
Violin. And
yep. And of course, Taylor Ray was in there doing her business.
I'm just saying.
Well, you know, Taylor coached me through the whole thing. I've never been really a strong vocalist, but she, you know, you just coached me through, like, aww, almost line by line. I think you can do that better. Here, try this. You know,
and you were fantastic.
It was really something. The sound was incredible. You know what? The whole thing I mentioned, which was different from Nashville, was you plugged me in a guitar and a mic, and I played with the band.
Yeah.
And you had me lay down the scratch track with the live band, and then we worked from there, which was so totally different than I'd ever done before here in Nashville.
No, that's great to hear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really great. Those artists that you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, that's how all those records were made.
Really?
And that's the way I learned how to do it, was with people in a room. Mm-hmm. And that's what the way you get results. You know, it's really interesting to me because I've been out to Nashville a few times over the years with
Taylor. You're on a working vacation, basically. Right?
Yeah, we're working in the studio. And it's interesting because the guy I'm working with is a client from San Diego who moved out here. Mm-hmm. A lot of people move out here with songs. Mm-hmm. And they do studio stuff, I think, a little differently, and I might be talking out of school, but I think a lot of people do stuff all in the computer.
Yeah.
Especially the younger folks.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
And I think that whole art of getting in a room and playing music together is being lost.
I love that.
You know, the guy that I'm working with, he says, I've been out here for 5 years, and a lot of the people I talk to just drag and drop drum tracks, bass tracks, and guitar tracks into a computer because it's easy and probably affordable. Mm. And they just kind of take it from there, and they sing over the stuff, and they put it out there, and that's it.
Or they piece it together. They'll do a drum track, and bass, you know.
It's pieced together a lot
now. And they piece it together, and then when they're ready, they bring the vocalist.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And, you know, everything's done in a few days, yeah. Right?
Right.
The music's done in a few days. The vocals are done in a few days.
Right.
It works because there's a lot of stuff that sounds great. I'm not arguing with it, but I think it's really great to be able to just, if you're going to go and record, make it the best experience possible for yourself.
And it was. And again, you're talking about being the vibe. I mean, you really feel the vibe when you've got that whole band playing with you and along with you.
It resonates with you more.
Yes, it does.
And you get better performances.
Yes, you do.
Don't you?
I agree. Totally. Yeah. You know, my song Baby I'm Gone, which is streaming out there right now. I think we probably have a new single out by then.
Woohoo!
But, right. That gave it a whole new feel, and I wanted it to be, because the Chancey Williams version was really heavy violin, heavy fiddle, lots of harmonies, and I wanted my own little take on it, and sent you a work tape, and boy, you seemed to hear it and know what it was going to be. And Mark Introvaya with the guitar and the slide, and he put this little I can't explain it. We called it an arpeggio kind of thing. That it was. It only came in its own melodic hook, basically.
Yeah, that's
in
right.
Song.
Yeah, he's a genius player. He understands songs and records very well.
His reputation preceded him, and having met him, I'm like, whoa, dude, good to finally meet you. And he was lived up to it. Let me.
He did, and it's really interesting how actually he ended up on your recording because I hadn't seen him in years, and I'd worked with him with a gal who's out here now called Eve Sellis, who's a big deal back in San Diego. And everybody knows who she is.
She's been on this podcast a couple times.
That's right.
I love her record, and I love what she does. She's an amazing. She's a Musicians Hall of Fame, right, in San Diego?
It probably is. I think she actually had her own day at one point. And I'd worked with her in 2008.
Did you? Okay.
And I met Mark during those sessions. We did the record, and I hadn't seen him for years because I'd just been working with other people. And then when Talon had been coming out here and was working with Eve, and then probably, I think you, that's how you guys met.
That's how I met her.
It just seemed totally appropriate that Mark should be back on the session working with you. So it all kind of came that full circle. Crazy. You know,
yeah.
It's funny. It's funny because I got a really good story. I met Eve Sellis and Mark Entrevaya because Burt Bacharach.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Was trying to book the studio that I was working at in Rancho Bernardo, which is a town like Hermitage outside San Diego. And Burt's people called me and I didn't have a piano. So I had to rent a piano to get Burt in. Mm. And the people came down with a piano and they said, we're not going to be able to get a piano through that door.
Oh, no.
There's no way. There's too many winding hallways. So what I had to do was cancel the session. I'm usually one of those guys. I'll make it work. If you got to have the session, I'll jump through hoops, you know? I mean, we'd had the Stones come into that studio, which is a story for another day or maybe today. I don't know.
No, we're going to hear it. I want to hear the Stones.
I couldn't get it in. I couldn't get the piano. So I thought, what am I going to do? I'm going to turn this bad press into good press. So I called a guy like the City Beat, which is like the Nashville, Nashville scene of San Diego. Mm-hmm. And he wrote an article about how Burt Bacharach couldn't get his piano on, you know, into the thing. Oh, and Tom Galata, Eve Sellis' husband, saw the article and said, hey, Eve, because Eve was looking to make a new record at the time. Mm-hmm. You should talk to this guy, Alan.
Huh?
So we started talking, and that's how we ended up doing a record. And here we are doing this podcast.
How about that?
So indirectly from Burt Bacharach. That's why we're sitting here.
I mean, what the?
You didn't even know that, did you?
Yeah.
No, I don't even know how much I knew of that story, but that was a great one.
It's like that game, 6 degrees of separation. There's only like 3 or 4 between Burt Bacharach and me.
I mean,
really?
Isn't that crazy? I mean, the talent is nuts. But,
isn't that nuts?
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the Stones. Now, come on. Tell us a Stones story that you worked with. It was what was the album?
Well, it was an album called Bridges to Babylon.
Bridges to Babylon.
Which came out in 97. And okay. I was working at Oceanway Studios, like I was saying. And I was one of the engineers that worked under a producer by the name of Don Was.
Don Was?
Yeah. And he's
spent
been around.
Some time in Nashville.
He spent some time in Nashville. In fact, the first record I did with him was an album called Country Rhythm and Blues that he was doing with Tony Brown.
Oh, my. Wow.
Him and Tony Brown were producing a record. And that was one of the first recordings I'd actually worked on with him, funny enough.
Wow.
You know,
Tony Brown. Played with Elvis, folks. We've talked about Tony.
That's right. And I think he was the head of one of the labels out here for a long time.
I want to say it was MCA. I could be wrong.
It's MCA.
It was MCA.
We just talked about that this morning.
Did you? Yeah.
Big time.
And he's in the, if he isn't, he's going in, I think, this fall to the Country Music Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he was put in. So anyway.
That's great. Yeah. Well, I remember that was one of the first sessions that I'd done with Don Was. I was like the second engineer's assistant. And it was Clint Black and the Pointer Sisters in the morning.
Wow.
Okay. And then Tanya Tucker and Little Richard in the afternoon.
Oh, my God. Okay. Wow.
And it was all live, right? It was all live.
You were recording it live.
Everybody was in the room playing together. Little Richard was in there on the piano doing his thing. And it was like, I think it was Jim Keltner or Kenny Aronoff playing drums. And just working with Don was great because he was the master of creating the vibe and setting it up. I don't know if you've ever met him or seen him.
I've seen him.
But he's the vibe setter. And he gets the best out of people, you know. And he knows how to deal with everybody and make everybody feel good, down to the engineer guy, the lowly guy that's getting the cables running, to the guy that's making the record. And so I just kind of started working with him more and more, and I just want to learn as much as I can from this guy, you know. So when he got selected to produce the Bridges to Babylon record, they chose Ocean Way, and he'd done Voodoo Lounge with them.
Wow.
So I'd been kind of in his path, and I decided to, whatever I was going to do when I heard the Stones were coming in, I was going to be one of the engineers on the session. So I got the gig.
Wow.
And it was just going to be a couple of weeks with Charlie Watts to get some drum tracks for, I think it was the Dust Brothers were doing some stuff. They were Beck's producer, and Babyface was doing some stuff, and they were just trying to get some tracks.
Mm.
And Charlie Watts was digging the studio so much that they ended up getting Keith down to the studio. It was just going to be a two-week session.
Uh-huh.
So Keith came out, and they started writing tunes in the studio. And the way the Stones work is that they write on the fly in the studio, and things kind of organically come together. So slowly but surely, different members started showing up. Like Mick Jagger, all of a sudden, a month later, is there. Ronnie Wood's showing up. Jim Keltner. And then next thing you know, we're in there, and it's 4 months in.
Wow.
And the session's been going gangbusters pretty much every day. For months, it turned into a 6 month recording session, which it was only going to be a 2 week session.
Jeez.
So
man.
It was crazy. And being the engineer guy, there was like me and two or three other guys working on the session. We would have to be there for Mick Jagger, who would come in at 11 o'clock in the morning, and he'd work until about six. And then Keith would come in with Ronnie, and they would work until about three or four in the morning. That was kind of when they were their best creative. A place during the night, and I would have to be there the entire time.
Wow, long days. Huh?
So yeah, so a lot of times I'd find myself sleeping on the couch. I mean, I was only a 27-year-old dude at the time, so I was hungry, and it didn't really matter.
Yeah,
you know,
right?
Sometimes I was living in Woodland Hills at the time, and just driving, it would just got too much. It was a place out, you know, 30 minutes outside of Hollywood. But just being around that session and seeing those guys play live together, it's hard to describe,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I was a 27-year-old schmuck basically thinking, oh, yeah, I got this figured out, you know, and I thought I understood what music was all about and rock and roll.
Yeah.
But when I saw those guys playing in the room together, there was many times I remember thinking to myself, I don't know anything about rock and roll. I don't know. you know, this is it right here. This is where it's at. This is how it's done. Anybody else thinks they can do it a different way, that's fine. But this is how it's done.
Mm.
You know, I'll never forget it.
So seeing, you really learned a lot in this.
I learned a lot about psychology more than anything, and seeing how these people interact with each other, not only musically in the studio, but outside the studio, and what it takes to make a record.
Mm-hmm.
And it was bizarre because we, like a normal record back then was about 30 reels of tape. Okay. We went through about 800 and something reels of tape on this.
Goodness.
So it didn't matter whatever it took to get the record done, get it done.
Big budgets.
It was a huge budget.
It would have to be.
It was whatever it takes, make it happen. And the record, all of a sudden one day the record was like done. Somebody said the record's done. That was it. You know, I didn't see it coming. It's like next week the record's over. So whatever we got here over the last 6 months, we're done because we're going on tour. You know,
do you edit on the fly? There isn't a guy that goes through 800 reels of tape, right? And picks out. How do they edit that much?
Well, my job was to log every single thing that happened. And, you know, there's probably a books sitting somewhere in The Hague because that's where all the tapes and all the documentation ends up.
Yeah.
For those guys is somewhere in The Hague, right?
Mm.
So there's probably a book with all my writing in it that's got every single thing that happened on those sessions for 6 months. If Charlie Watts walked into the room after dinner and he started playing the drums, mm-hmm. I had to be in record.
Oh gosh.
Because mm-hmm. Keith could all of a sudden walk in the room and start playing. And if he starts playing with Charlie and somebody's not recording it, heads are going to roll.
You never know what you're missing, right?
You don't.
Yeah.
So sometimes you'd capture magic that way. That's why I was always like, you know, hey, did you record that? Were you in record? Dude, it's a recording studio, right?
That's what
I always tell people, you know?
Yeah.
So capturing those guys any minute could turn into something. And I had to have it logged. Because maybe Charlie Watts would walk into the studio a month later and say, hey, remember that thing we did back in blah, 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 and it sounded, had this jazz feel? I'd have to find the reel in the notebook where it was in the vault, get it up, get it playing before they were in the room. And it had to happen fast.
Big job.
It had to happen real fast.
You had to be good at logging everything, didn't you?
Everything.
Absolutely.
Or else things you'd get fired.
You had to handwrite it.
Everything was handwritten.
Jeez.
There was no computer. Because it was 97. And, you know, Pro Tools was kind of around.
And the tapes you were using were the big...
It was the two-inch tapes.
Two-inch tapes.
It was the two-inch tapes. And we'd have two machines. So if they were playing, the tape only had 16 and a half minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So if the tape on machine A was running out, we had to have another machine ready to go in to record on so that if they wanted to hear the song back, we could splice the two reels together so they could hear it.
Wow.
And we had to splice it together fast. So fortunately, we didn't have to do that very often. But when we nowadays you cut and paste it.
Yeah, but back then you physically
you'd find the
physically cut and paste it. Yeah.
Physically, man, and you had to be good at it. So when Pro Tools came around, coming from that school of editing, it made it a lot easier to understand where to edit things. But
of all these stars that you've worked with, did you have a favorite one that you would just go to the wall for?
Well, I mean, working on that session. I'll never forget it. It's always going to be part of me. I mean, it was 6 months, and I always think about it, and sometimes I get a little nostalgic about the whole thing because it was an incredible experience, you know. There was a lot of great artists that came in there, and I was lucky enough because I think they always stuck with the British guys because of my background, and I would get stuck with guys like, you know, like Elton came in for a month when it became Cello Studios. And working with him was
amazing. Huh?
It was incredible because I think still to this day, he's one of the greatest artists of all time.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he would come in the morning and he was working with Bernie Taupin at the time, who was the guy that co-wrote all those great songs.
Yeah. Did all the lyrics, right?
All the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And Taupin would hand Elton the lyrics at 10 o'clock in the morning. And Elton would go and sit at the piano and write the songs.
Are you kidding me? That's how it worked.
And he would write them with a piano.
In the studio.
In the studio. And I was the tape op. I always got the wonderful job of having to run the tape machine. So Elton would be writing the lyrics, and I would be following along with Elton on the tape machine. And he, oh, stop, go back, punch in. So I'd have to punch. And sometimes he wouldn't communicate to me very well where he'd want to be punched in. So I would be, I'm shaking just thinking about it, Dave.
I'll bet.
Yeah, I'm shaking.
That's stress.
Because you can't erase Elton John. You can, okay? Mm. So I had to be one step ahead of them at all times. But because I'd worked with the Stones a few years beforehand, mm-hmm. and I'd spent a bunch of time, a couple of years with Fleetwood Mac doing stuff, cutting my teeth with those guys. So working with these high-caliber artists was... I'd had the experience to be able to deal with it.
Right.
I wouldn't recommend it to somebody starting out. But it was still nerve-wracking at the time.
I bet.
But, you know, this whole thing you're doing here... And by the way, you're doing a fantastic job with all these writers here. And,
I know this isn't really a writer's one, but I'm just your stories are just so great, and I wanted to share those with folks because you don't get to talk to people every day that has worked with royalty like you have.
Yeah, I guess not. I mean, you know, getting into this writing thing, you know, it's like this guy was handed lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a song in 30 minutes by himself at the piano.
That's the kind of talent we're talking about.
And, you know,
crazy.
One time we took a lunch break. We came back 45 minutes later. He'd written two songs.
Jeez.
By himself at the piano. And world class. Some of the songs were so deep that, you know, it wasn't really set up for release on this particular record we were working on. The producer was a guy by the name of Pat Leonard who had produced... a lot of Madonna's early records and a lot of amazing records. Great, great guy. But yeah, I mean.
Wow. It's incredible. Incredible. How about Fleetwood Mac? You always hear stories about, you know, the friction between the band members and stuff. Total professional in the studio? Or
well,
incidents?
I ended up working with those guys because they were working on an album called Time, and they'd had a thing happening where Dave Mason was now in the band from the band Traffic. And
Dave Mason.
Dave Mason's incredible. Yeah. And a gal by the name of Becca Bramlett, who is, I think, was it
Delaney and Bonnie?
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. She was in there, and it was Mick Fleetwood, John McVie, and Christine McVie. And they were working on a record for a couple of years. And the guy that was the main engineer, Scottish guy, was kind of he was my mentor, a guy by the name of Ken Allardyce.
Okay.
He's actually now a laird in the north of Scotland doing his thing.
A laird.
He's a landowner up in Scotland. But he was he's made some great records and a great name to his own right. he brought me in, and I became his assistant, and I worked on that album, and it slowly turned into a Lindsey Buckingham album that went on for a few years and then ended up turning into an album called Say You Will.
Okay.
And The Dance, where they got reconnected. But it was 2 years.
Wow.
About 2 years with those guys.
And in the making.
In the making. And it's another situation where the writing was happening in the studio, and guys were, and gals, they were coming up with ideas. We'd go an 11 to 5. It was like a day job. Even somebody had to pinch me and go, hey, it's not normally like this. You know what I mean? You don't normally come in at 11 and leave at 5, you know, yeah. Monday through Friday. It was like a dream job. Yeah. You know, I was working with Fleetwood Mac, doing a day job Monday through Friday for about 2 years.
Wow.
And every day I was with
them. You get to know the guys pretty well.
You got to, I got to know them. And I got to see how they operated and how they worked. And I got to see a lot of... interesting ideas come together, and as far as the stories go, yeah, the stories were incredible. I mean, you know, you got to hear firsthand the stuff that happened in the Rumors and the Tango in the Night, all those great albums. And you know, I kept my mouth shut. My job was just to keep my mouth shut and make sure things worked.
Yeah,
but I was listening the whole time and I was paying attention. I think it's really important. I don't think people do that enough these days, is pay attention to what's going on. But yeah, what a learning experience.
Amazing.
That was.
Amazing.
And they're all just unbelievable. Lindsey Buckingham is...
What a talent. Man. Yeah. Something else.
All of them.
Well, I'm going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to talk about how it started for you.
Okay.
And I want to hear some more of these stories. I want to hear the Michael Jackson story.
Yeah, sure. I got one of those.
Okay. Don't go away.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to The Songwriter Connection with Dave Linehan. Find us on Facebook and YouTube at The Songwriter Connection Podcast. And find Dave at thedaveconnection.com. Now back to the show with your host, Dave Linehan.
So this is where I'd normally remind you, if you're watching on YouTube, and I know it's not a video podcast, but we just put it in there so you can listen, you know. And if you are, like and subscribe. So use that little... arrow button. What is it? It looks like a thumbs up. Is that what it is?
Thumbs up.
And you click on that and then hit the subscribe for me, because that really helps. It really does. The other thing I wanted to remind you about, and I always forget to remind you, every week when I publish, and we publish on Wednesday mornings, I take some of the songs that you've heard and I put it on a Spotify playlist. So if you go to the Songwriter Connection podcast songs, you'll find us, and they just stream. You can just put it on, you know, shuffle, and you can listen to all the songs.
I didn't know that.
There's even a song of you.
No.
Oh, there, Taylin.
No way. Dang.
Sure there is.
I'm headed over.
So check that out, if you will.
That's great.
For the Songwriter Connection. Well, Alan Sanderson is our guest. He's a Grammy Award-winning engineer and producer, owns Pacific Beat, along with Taylin Ray in San Diego. First of all, I want to hear about the Grammy. Tell me about, I got to hold a Grammy. Yeah, and let me tell you, okay, I have to also tell you this. This is funny. I got off the plane from San Diego, right? I had a text from a friend, give me a call. And I call her and she says, hey, I wrote this movie. It's called Music City Mistletoe. And it's kind of like one of those Hallmark kind of films. And I want you to be in it. And I'm like, you're kidding me, right?
Wow.
This is the day I got off the plane from San Diego.
Wow.
So I acted,
that's what I remember.
I acted in this film, and I played a songwriter by the name of Tom Martin. And so basically I was playing myself. But here's the difference. Tom Martin had a lot more hits. Number ones. And he even had a Grammy or two. And I'm like, well, I held a Grammy.
I have a picture of that. I do. I'll send it over.
Yeah. You know what? And I'll put it on the Facebook page so you can see.
All right.
It's in a really nice place in Pacific Beach on this table next to a lava lamp.
Yeah, there you go.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, yeah. You gotta keep it cool, you know?
Oh, yeah. Was the vibe. Let me tell you. I never, always wanted to buy a lava lamp. Never had one. Wouldn't look good here in this.
Well, I should have given you one. I've got tons of extra ones lying around. Yeah.
So
You got to change the bulb, probably.
But the dining room studio needs a lava lamp.
It does.
Doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, we got Funko Pops. We got, Yeah. What the heck?
Got Snowman.
On my list, man. I got Amazon. Yeah. I'll be hitting Amazon tonight and banging up. I'll be looking at your address on the way out of here.
Oh, come on. Get out of here. Don't do that. You don't have to. So anyway, it's just a pleasure to have you. But tell me the story of the Grammy. I mean, that had to be just so special.
Well, I mean, it's interesting how that came together because it was very unexpected, honestly. And I guess it probably is a lot of times with people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I was traveling a lot when I kind of left the studios, just doing freelance, wanting to get out. And, you know, I was lucky enough to go down to, like, Brazil and work there for a year. And I ended up in Africa and built a studio. And
did you build a studio in Africa?
I built a studio in Namibia with some guys down there.
Wow.
Some geologists turned musicians that wanted me to come down.
Cool.
That was a great experience. I'd gone everywhere. You know, you're always looking for that one thing that's going to be the thing, whatever that thing may be. And, you know, I came back to San Diego and I had some downtime. And things were a little slow for me, actually. And you're always given second thoughts. Is music what I want to be doing? Should I maybe hang it up and go get a real job, you know? But I got a call from somebody saying, hey, you know, these guys, this band up here, Switchfoot, couple of blocks away from where I grew up in San Diego, wanted an engineer coming to cut drums. So I went in and I cut drums for these guys. It was a makeshift studio. There was a couple of things here and there. It was a challenge, but got the drums done. A couple of weeks later, thanks very much. See you later. Never heard from him. Never saw him again.
Wow.
Fast wind. A year later, I'm in Switzerland doing a record for some Swiss bankers. And I get a call from a guy.
No, you got to tell the real story, okay. Like the real one. Don't even. I mean, the people want to hear the story.
Go. Okay, well,
that's why she's here, right? Because I'm not going to talk, you know. But, I love it. Love you.
Love you.
Well, it was a month before that because I was standing in Target. Actually, sending in Target. You always think, oh yeah, I'm going to win a Grammy. I'm going to be putting on a tuxedo and going up there and all that wonderful stuff. But
were you looking for?
I was looking for underwear in Target.
Okay.
I was looking for underwear in Target, and a colleague of mine, another guy, Steve Churchard is his name. He's an incredible engineer, made a bunch of great records, and he happened to be at the Grammys because he was up for a Latin Grammy, I think. Uh-huh. And he sends me a text and says, hey, Al, he says, I think you've won yourself a Grammy. So I'm looking at the underwear in one hand.
I would have to change my underwear right then. Go ahead.
So I put the underwear down and I left. And I think it was like a month later I was in Switzerland and a Grammy showed up. That's what it was. A Grammy actually showed up in a box up my family's doorstep. And you know, it was kind of, you know, they opened the box, hey, the Grammy's here.
Oh my goodness.
That's what it was. And I was working with these guys. It's like, just hold on to it. I'll get it when I get back. But it was so bizarre how it all kind of came together because it wasn't expected. I didn't expect it at all. And I was blessed to be in that situation just for a few weeks because it was enough. And I think to be qualified to actually get a statue, you have to work on over 50% of the album. And I'd recorded, I think, over six song drum tracks on that album.
Did you?
That qualified me enough to get it.
That's awesome.
So I put that in the studio with pride.
How much did that change your career?
You know, it's interesting. It helped me get the studio, you know, because when I originally spoke to the landlords, they didn't do a credit check or any kind of background check on me because they said, if you've got a Grammy, then you're good enough to rent the space. So I guess in retrospect, it did a lot for my career.
So you saved $30.
I saved $30 on the credit check.
Credit check.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. My my credit was always been pretty good, you know,
good.
But, you never know if it's good enough for the landlords to take over a spot.
That's right.
So, you know, it's opened up a few doors for me and it's given me some opportunities to do things. And
You know, walking in that studio, I still remember all the pictures you get on the wall there of the people that you've worked with. And it's just so impressive. Like Bert and Elvis Costello.
It was great to work on that record. Painted from Memory was summer of 98. I remember working on that. And again, another situation where everybody's in the room playing live together. Mm-hmm. All that stuff was done live. That was special. Yeah. Because you had these two amazing minds working together from two completely different schools of record making and collaborating and sitting there watching this go down. I was the tape op. The head engineer, the main engineer was a guy called Kevin Killen. who'd done a lot of the Peter Gabriel and Elvis Costello records. Wow. I think he recorded So. So he was the main guy. And
still
I was
still one of my favorite albums.
Brilliant record, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very natural sounding record. If you listen to Painted from Memory, it has this sound to it. But being the tape op guy, we all had to read charts and we had to follow along. Bert was all about the charts. Mm-hmm. And if you couldn't read a chart, you were out.
Wow.
And we did a lot of orchestral stuff and we had to be able to follow along. And he would go in and change the charts on the fly if it needed to be. If there was like a 50 people out there playing and Bert was direct, he was the conductor, mm-hmm. he would change stuff on the fly when needed. And it was just amazing to see that happen. Yeah. And,
Top-notch musicians, man.
Never be able to be something mm-hmm. like that, but he comes from a different place.
You know, I always was a big fan of Elvis Costello, but when those two got together, I don't think I've ever heard a more pure voice in my life. Alice, his voice was just incredible in those records.
It's so really interesting, man, that you say that, because one of the fondest memories I have was, you know, I got to set up the session. I got to put the mics up. I got to get everything ready to go. And we had a U-47, a Neumann U-47. I don't know if you're familiar with the microphones, but that's like the go-to. That's, I think Taylan might have used some of that. We had the mic set up. And he stepped up to the mic, and I got to have everything ready. The headphones have to be ready to go. It's got to be ready. Yep. There's nothing, I can't hear myself. That can't happen. Mm-hmm. So he walks up to this mic, and he starts singing. And right away, I remember, I'm getting goosebumps right now.
Yeah.
Man, thinking about it, because it's like,
so smooth.
That's Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
You know, that's his sound. And that's one of the things, you know, I recommend to anybody out there is finding your own sound. Mm-hmm. You know, he had his... That was his personality, you know what I mean? Yeah. Coming through that mic, you know? Everything, his whole body, his existence. It was just incredible.
That is incredible.
And he put everything into that record.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Oh, man.
I got to see him a couple of years ago at Ryman Auditorium.
Okay.
The first time. And it was an amazing show.
Okay.
Great show.
Oh, he's amazing. His band is great.
Absolutely incredible. You had kind of a stressful time with Michael Jackson. Didn't you?
A little bit.
A little bit?
It was intense.
I had you had a story that you shared one time, and I wondered if you'd share it with me again.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Jackson used those studios back in the 80s and 90s. I think he did Thriller, the studio complex. Again, it was Ocean Way Studios, which is the same, similar to Ocean Way Nashville, even though I think it's been sold. There was Ocean Way in Hollywood, and there was Record One in the San Fernando Valley. They were both kind of shared by the same guy, and Michael worked at Record One, and because I think he lived close to it.
Oh, did he? Okay.
And he would sometimes use the Ocean Way studio because there was a big room down there and you could do orchestral stuff and choir and whatnot, and he did choir down there on a day that I was asked to come in and engineer or assist whoever the engineer was in getting the thing done. And I can't remember who the engineer was. I don't even think there was one. I think I became the de facto engineer for that session. And it was very intense because there was a lot of people running around and everybody's, you know, fired up and, you know, this and that. And
they said,
it's a Michael Jackson session. This is big.
Yeah.
So two tape machines showed up. It was digital tape machines at that time. It was right before Pro Tools started really taking on.
Okay.
And they were 48-track tape machines.
Wow.
And we had two 48-track tape machines synced up, and all the tracks were full on all the tapes. So you had 96 tracks
kidding me?
Synced up. That's a lot of technology.
That really is. You know.
So I had
before Pro Tools. I mean,
it was insane. If you think about it now, right?
Yeah,
that's a lot for a Pro Tools session. So
yeah.
I had to have all the cables and everything coming up to the desk. Which
are there 96 channels on the board?
It was an 80 input board,
okay.
And there wasn't enough channels to bring up all the tracks.
So what do you do? You gotta like overdub something?
Well, there was like an old monitor section over on the side. So I think it was like 24 channels of monitoring. So it might have been about...
Use the monitor.
So it was 100 and something channels. And you got to make sure it's all working because was a vintage Neve.
And that's your job. That's what you had to do.
It's all got to be working. But I don't have time to test 100 and something inputs.
No,
you know,
I'm
just patching everything up, right? Yeah. So because it was kind of intense, I had an intern hook up some of the stuff behind the machine. And, you know, you learn as you go. But to try and make this long story as short as I can, we were ready to go. Everything's running. Choir's happening. We're running the song. I forget what the song was. Michael shows up. He comes in the room, sits down. He starts producing. Everything's going great. I'm nervous, terrified. Yeah. Okay. This was right after the Stone session. So I'm like, I can handle this.
Yeah.
If it was a whole nother level, it's like stress. You know what I mean? So, and I'm just praying that everything works.
Yeah.
You got to have all the stuff available for him on the desk in case he needs to hear it. We're running. We're going. Everything's smooth. And all of a sudden we get to this like take five of the choir. And I'm going into input on the machine and nothing's working.
Oh, no.
Nothing. And I'm getting scared. I'm getting frantic. Oh. You know, that nervous feeling. I'm sure everybody's had it where you're getting dehydrated and people are asking you what's wrong. And you're like, and you call the tech guy in. And all of a sudden it's getting really intense in there. And the guys that had been sitting back in the room who had been quiet were now getting fired up.
Oh, boy.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So lights are down in the control room because he didn't want the choir seeing into the control room. So I'm dealing with a dark control room. The tech guy's in there trying to help me troubleshoot it. We're changing everything, and I remember. I let the intern set up the machine. It's got to be the back of the machine. So I get back behind the machine. I see it. My experience. All right, switched it out. As I'm switching it, I got barely any room. I pull the power cable out with my foot by accident.
Oh, no.
And I hear this bang in the monitors. And all of a sudden, it's dead quiet. And I hear this little voice. Feet don't fail me now.
Jeez.
And I'm back there behind the machine thinking, wait a minute. Did Michael Jackson just acknowledge that I just pulled the power cable out and just screwed this session up? But what it did was when he said that, all of a sudden all the people that had been yelling and screaming, what's going on, started laughing because they thought it was hilarious. Because Michael Jackson could say anything and everyone's going to start laughing.
It broke the tension.
You know, it broke the tension. That was a tension breaker. Talk about all about the vibe, my friend. That was one of those moments.
That was the vibe.
So I plugged the machine back in, jump back on the remote, get the tracks and input. I just hit play from the beginning. We're back in the session. I'm holding on for dear life. Because you only get one of those on a session.
Yeah.
An hour goes by. Session's done. We've landed the plane. And Michael looks at me and he goes, thank you very much. You did such a great job. It was wonderful meeting you. Shook my hand and left. And that was it.
Unreal.
It was like this afternoon that just... you can guess where I went after that.
The nearest...
the closest cocktail bar. Yeah, although I don't...
Watering hole. Yeah, absolutely. That would have too. Absolutely.
But that was a good one.
Very cool.
Great memory.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Thanks for sharing these stories. This is really
thanks for
what
asking.
I wanted to do. I really wanted to talk about things like that. Man. You know, I don't even know where to go from here. It's crazy. How did you get started?
Well, I got started because, I remember...
Tell the real story.
I mean, I probably, needed to find a job, honestly. So I just moved up to Hollywood.
Okay, so you came, you'd already been here.
Well, you know what's crazy, man, is I was working in a restaurant, 18, 19, and every night I'd be cleaning up the place, and I'd always be listening.
Cleaning chickens.
I'd always have Fleetwood Mac playing, Fleetwood Mac's greatest hits.
Oh, wow.
Playing on the jukebox every night, you know, You Make Love and Fun.
Yeah.
All those great records that they had throughout the chain, all that stuff. And I would always tell myself, man, it would be so great to, you know, get into working on records and doing this. Because I played music.
Did you?
I played in bands.
What was your instrument?
I played bass. I played a little guitar. I did play in bands. When I moved to Hollywood, I was in like three bands. I did the whole thing. You know, I probably didn't go as far as I wanted to go. But I could play music enough to be dangerous. You know?
Like me.
And... And I got a job at a studio and basically just kind of worked my way up the ladder at Ocean Way. And eventually,
tell the story though about how you got your job at Ocean Way. How, I'm not going to say it for you, but how you sent out.
When I got to LA,
because your parents said get off the couch.
Well, they better say, you better get yourself a job.
You better get yourself a job.
It's very Scottish.
Very Scottish, yeah.
So, I was up there looking through the yellow pages for studios. And this was back in the day when you would take your resume, put it in an envelope, and send it.
Yeah.
And there was no email, man. You put a postage stamp on it and send it out and hope that somebody got back to you. And I got two responses, one from the record plant and one from Ocean Way, which
crazy.
Was
crazy.
Which was kind of like the greatest studio. It was like Abbey Road.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was playing music, and one day I got the call, and it was either keep playing music and make no money or get a job at a studio and make barely any money.
Oh, boy.
So I got a job sweeping floors and getting people food, you know, going out and running errands. I mean, my first day at the studio was actually Stevie Nicks was working in the studio. I'll never forget this as long as I live. And Glyn Johns was producing the Stevie Nicks stuff. And Glyn Johns is well known because he worked on a lot of Zeppelin and Stones, and he worked with the Beatles. He was in that Get Back documentary. Yeah. He was the producer in that.
Yeah,
he was the guy.
Alan Parsons was running the.
Alan Parsons would have been one of the engineers, probably after Glyn Johns. Glyn Johns was the engineer.
Okay.
So he was producing Stevie Nicks on day one, and my job was to make sure to clean all the studios. It was very overwhelming, so I didn't clean the studio up to snuff, and I didn't change the flowers. So Glyn Johns called the front desk and complained.
No.
But what do you... I'll get to that in a minute. He complained. So I went in there day two. Studio manager calls me up, says, look, here's the deal. We got a complaint from one of our clients, Glyn Johns, who's working with Stevie Nicks, and he complained about the flowers, and if you do that again, you're out. I said, but I just got here. I don't want to hear it. He says to me,
"Wow,
you mess up again, you're gone." Okay, it's Hollywood, right?
Right.
You know, so I never messed up again.
Never did.
So rewind.
What kind of flowers did you get?
Fast forward. I forget what they were, but we never, you know, we never made that mistake again. So fast forward. Sorry, 8 more years. I'm working with Glyn Johns as his engineer on a Country Bears record. Oh, Don Henley's on the record. The guy from Men at Work is on the record. And I was the engineer. And we cut these tracks. And Glyn and I are having lunch, and nobody else is around. And we're talking. And we end up spending 4 hours in the studio talking about engineering and what it takes and how things have changed. And I'm hanging with him. And I'm going to tell him the story. And I tell him the story about the flowers on my first day. Mm. And he starts laughing his head off. And he says, these people here... they never get my sense of humor.
Oh, he was just joking.
He was only joking. He was only joking.
Oh,
and I said, you
goodness.
Almost cost me my career.
Oh,
you know what I mean? Because
God.
Of that one fateful day where I didn't change the flowers.
Listen, pal, you owe me.
But that was kind of the British sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's this dry sense of humor. Like, these bloody flowers better be changed or I'm never... You know, so everybody's like walking on eggshells because it's the famous Glyn Johns. So I think that a lot of times I would be put on these British rock and roll guys sessions at Ocean Way because...
You got the sense of humor.
I understood the sense of humor. Like when Charlie Watts giving you a hard time or Keith's giving you a hard time, he's really not. He's just joking with you.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So I think that was kind of my pathway to a lot of those credits. And
something
I'm
else.
Thankful for it because the gal that was running the studio, I had a great relationship with her, and she was really trying to help me out with my career. And I saw her not too long ago. And
that's awesome.
Thanked her for... put me on all those sessions, and we had a good laugh about it.
Pretty darn cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
So today, kind of the king of recording in San Diego. So everybody goes to you, huh?
I guess so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different vibe.
Uh-huh.
There we go again with that word down there. You know, I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I do. It's challenging, like any studio anywhere.
Sure.
But it seems to work out, and I get a lot of great musical talent that comes through there. I work with a lot of people like yourself. You know, it was a real treat to have you out there, Dave, working with the
oh man, it was just the highlight of my
you know
my life. Yeah,
it was wonderful.
You guys got the best out of me. You know,
it was great. You know that kind of stuff. I get a lot of independent artists, and I think that's kind of where it's gone now.
I think so too.
Even
they
in
seem
Nashville.
To be making more money, you know, than the major label guys.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of folks are finding their own way doing it. You know,
absolutely.
I mean, the big budgets and the 800 reels of tape, although I'm sure the Stones can still do that, but you know, it's few and far between now.
Yeah.
I think that...
you know, comparing the digital age to when you did it analog style, I mean, there's really no comparison, but I mean, as far as everybody was saying, like, analog is warmer and something was lacking with digital. Do you have any thoughts or feelings on that?
I think, yeah, I do actually. I still like the sound of analog a lot.
Me too.
And I definitely find it has a certain impact when you on the listener. Mm-hmm. You know, there are ways to emulate that with digital. I don't know if it's quite there. It's close. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, I don't know. It's like it's kind of become apples and oranges to some degree. I think I've heard a lot of amazing digital recordings, and I don't know. It's a different kind of thing.
It's a different world, huh?
But you know,
tools have made the job a little easier, though, hasn't it?
Much, well, too easy sometimes.
Too easy,
you know, because now you can, with AI and everything, you can drag and drop your song into AI, and it'll analyze it for you and tell you what you need to add to it,
wow,
or what you need to do. And it's changed a lot. Although I've heard some AI stuff, and it doesn't really resonate with me.
I can pick it out.
Yeah, I think you probably, you see, it's a feeling thing. Feeling it. It's, yeah.
There's a program we talked a little bit about, the podcast. I think it was probably last week's podcast, about AI and this program Suno, where you can put a work tape in it. It's in a matter of seconds. It spits out, and you go, "Wow, how does it do that?" But you know, it's not a real voice, you know. And I mean, you could feel it.
Yeah, you can.
You know,
it's how it resonates with you as a listener.
Yeah.
You know, you're creating energy.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing in the studio.
That's what you're doing.
You're creating energy and you're capturing it. Right, so
I was going to say, you capture that energy.
You capture an energy, and that energy resonates with a listener or it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it's in tune or it's a little out of tune, or if it's, you know,
absolutely,
all those things make the whole. So I think when you start getting computers doing it, you know, it's like,
I think there's beauty in imperfection too.
I do too.
I really do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's like if AI writes a book.
Yeah.
I don't know. You those experiences. When somebody writes a book, those experiences, what you're getting out of that, those human experiences.
Exactly.
And I think the same goes for writing and performing
and recording.
Yeah, there you go. So
I'm going to play a little bit of one of these songs that we, just so people could hear what,
yes,
what it sounds like.
Great, man.
In Pacific Beach Studio. I really love this one right here. It's a song I wrote with Scott Barrier and Andrew Mack. And I always love this song. A lot of times I'll start a set off with this song. And the instrumentation was amazing. And you brought Paul in the last day to add the fiddle. It was just amazing. So here you go. Die on This Barstool. Produced Pacific Beat.
There you go, man.
By Alan Taylan, the vocal coach here.
Love it. Great.
Well, guys, I'm good. Living my best life. And these spirits got my soul feeling just right. Here in my home, away from home. Now, this might be crazy talk, y'all, but I've been thinking about my last call. And I know how I want to go.
That country music.
With an empty shot glass, a beer in my hand, and sing me back home some night. A house band.
Tailing on the VGB.
My old honky tonk crew. This bar stool. Well, it's happy hour heaven, it never gets old. And these hardwood floors, they're my streets of gold. Everybody in this bar treats me like a star. So if I kick the bucket, don't want to see no tears. In fact, the last thing that I want to hear is the cry of a fiddle and an old steel guitar. A beer in my hand and sing me back home, sung by the house band, surrounded by my old honky tonk crew. If I could choose, I wanna die on this bar stool.
That's Mark Twain right there on that slide. Paul Castellano.
All I ask is a plaque on the back of this chair. So everybody knows I die with a smile right here. Choose, I wanna die on this bar stool. If I could
That's brilliant, you guys. I can't thank you enough for the hard work I know that you put into that whole whole project there. Musicians were just incredible. It should be out there streaming by now. If not, it's going to be very, very soon. We had a little delay because Baby I'm Gone caught a little fire.
Congratulations.
And, yeah, congrats for that, man.
Yeah, and we're going to even do
you're working it.
A video on this one.
Yeah, you got to.
Ooh, will you
yeah,
do it when I'm in town?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely. I wish you were in town the last time.
I know.
We had to get two different people to play you.
Oh.
Boo. Yeah, I dug that video.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was so good.
Yeah. Baby, I'm Gone. You find it out there. You can just Google it and find the video. It was so much fun to make. We had this.
Looks like it.
I put up, just for the heck of it, I put on Facebook. I said, listen, we're looking for an old rusted truck. If anybody's got one that we can use for this video. And this gal, Kristen Holsey from outside of Atlanta, she goes, my dad's got this truck. And she sent me a picture of it. It's beautiful. It's a 56 white truck with the patina and the rust on it and everything. But the thing had a Corvette engine in it.
Beautiful
wheels, you know. And he drove it up. they put it on a trailer and they drove it up.
Wow.
And we found this abandoned gas station. There's this abandoned station on Old Murfreesboro Pike here in Nashville. It was built in like the 20s when cars were like really new, and they can't tear it down because it's a historical property.
Oh, wow.
Nobody uses it. It's just sitting there. So we didn't ask permission. We just drove off with the car there. That's awesome. We did the whole scene of me during the working on the truck right there.
That was a great video. I thought you guys did a great job.
It was so much fun. It was a blast. So we're going to do the same thing on Die on This Barstool. We haven't figured out the story yet, but we're going to do it.
You know? It looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Man, so much fun. You guys, thank you so much for sharing the great stories.
Yeah, and, thanks for having me.
I could talk to you all day long about the... you've worked with all my heroes. You know?
Oh, man.
So really cool. And Taylan,
yeah. I
mean, you're amazing.
Thank you. So are you.
My new bestie.
I mean, come on.
You pulled it out of me that whole session. You
were good, though. I didn't have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Oh, come on.
Yes, she did.
Don't undersell yourself.
You know, it was so funny because it never rains in Southern California, right? Except for the first 3 days that I got.
Yeah. Man,
wow.
But it was okay because, you know, in the vocal sessions, we had the throat coat tea and a little Jameson's.
Yeah, it did. That helps.
Little coffee cup Jameson. Yeah. Got to do what you got to do.
You talking about the vibe?
I'm talking about the vibe.
That was the vibe. So. Well, I hope you enjoyed. This is a little different for us on the podcast, but I hope you enjoyed the stories and enjoyed making the connection with Alan and Taylan as much as I have. Listen, like I always say, right on. We'll catch you next week. That's WRITE.
We hope you enjoyed this intimate glimpse into the world of songwriting and found inspiration in the stories shared by our talented guests. Remember, the magic of music lies not only in the notes and chords, but in the emotions and experiences woven into every lyric. Until next time, keep listening, keep creating, and keep the melodies alive.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.